Hello, and welcome to Inside Briefing, the podcast from the Institute for Government. My name is Tim Durrant, IFG Associate Director, and this week's presenter. Boris Johnson can't shake off questions about standards in Parliament and MPs' jobs, and their second jobs, and neither can we. We're keeping track of the latest developments in the fast-moving and seemingly never-ending row that is gripping Westminster. We're then going to shift gear and slip into the VIP lane, also known as the high-priority lane. This week, we've heard about the way the government scrambled to secure supplies of personal protective equipment, PPE, during the pandemic. Data has just been released about a whole load of contracts. We're going to take a look at what it tells us. And after that, we're heading north of the border. This week, John Swinney, the Deputy First Minister of Scotland, gave a talk at the IFG, and he did not hold back. More of that to come. It really has been a packed week. The Prime Minister had pretty much lost his voice by the end of it, but I'm delighted to be joined by an IFG colleague who has no such problems. In fact, she hasn't really stopped talking about this since the whole jobs and standards row blew up. Hannah White, our Deputy Director, joins me now. Hi, Hannah. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, Tim.
And I'm delighted that we're joined by Henry Dyer, politics reporter, Insider. Hi, Henry. You were called a tool by Dominic Cummings on Twitter the other day. Is that a badge of honour?
Oh, well, it's in my Twitter bio, so yes.
It's great to have you with us. Thank you for joining us. Right, let's get started. Owen Paterson would have been more than halfway through his suspension by now if the government hadn't intervened. Instead, Boris Johnson is still caught up in battles with Labour, with the media, and with plenty of his own MPs to show that he takes the issue of parliamentary standards seriously and has a plan to fix the problem and the other problems he may well have created in the last fortnight. This week, the Prime Minister set out a plan to overhaul the standards system, which he dropped just as Keir Starmer started a press conference setting out Labour's own position. How convenient. For this section, we're joined by Alice Lilly, senior researcher and parliamentary watcher at the IFG as well. Welcome, Alice.
Hi, Tim.
So, Hannah, yesterday Parliament debated and voted on the various competing visions for standards reform. Last week, you asked me what on earth was going on in Parliament. So now it's my turn. What on earth is going on in Parliament?
Well, I did end last week's podcast by saying, hopefully we won't be talking about standards this time next week, but here we are again. So, yeah, since last week's podcast, on Monday, we were supposed to clear up the Owen Paterson case with a straight vote in Parliament just to agree the Standards Committee report. But somebody, a veteran Conservative MP called Christopher Chope, objected to that, so it didn't go through on the nod. That meant that the government painfully had to schedule a debate on Tuesday when the question of whether the House should agree with the sanction being given to Owen Paterson was again debated, and it was this time agreed to. Then, on just to continue the week of standards stuff, on Wednesday, the Labour Party tabled an Opposition Day motion, which was calling on the House to introduce new rules around second jobs for MPs, and the government put forward its own proposals, which in the event were agreed to. They were slightly stronger than the Labour proposals. Labour said, although they had said that if they came into power, they would ban all second jobs except a few, for the purposes of this debate, they proposed only adopting one recommendation that's previously been made by the Committee on Standards and Public Life, which was about stopping MPs taking up political or parliamentary consultancy jobs of the sort that Owen Paterson had and got into trouble for. So they put that forward. The government's amendment to that motion said they wanted to get rid of those sorts of jobs, but also put reasonable limits on the amount of second jobs, third jobs, fourth jobs, the amount of time that MPs could spend not serving the needs of their constituents. And that's what was agreed to. So we're now waiting to see what process will happen. Primarily, we think that the Committee on Standards will need to complete its report, which it was already doing when this whole row blew up, and that they will bring forward proposals on how, in practice, we can give effect to this decision of the House made yesterday that actually they do want to put constraints on second jobs.
Henry, Keir Starmer was quick to chalk up the Prime Minister's announcement that he did want to make a move on second jobs as a Labour victory. Do you think it was smart politics of the PM to unveil his plan at the same time as Labour were doing theirs?
Well, I was running late for Starmer's press conference, but got in just after he was starting, introduced by Angela Rayner. And literally as Angela started speaking, I think the news came out, the tweet came out, and obviously all the journalists have seen it, but and all the press officers have seen it, and were sort of suitably aghast as Angela and Keir started speaking for about 10 minutes about something where they weren't entirely up to date with what had actually happened. But soon enough, a note came over, and Starmer was very quick to say, "Well, this is a victory. We've pushed the government into taking action." But he was tempering it by saying, "But obviously, you know, with Boris Johnson, you have to actually see what comes out, as opposed to just what's promised."
So it does feel like the Prime Minister is trying to kind of get on the front foot on this. He was also up in front of the liaison committee earlier this week talking about this as well. Do you feel like he's in charge?
Well, I think his Tory MPs don't feel that he's in charge. And I think judging by the front pages this morning and his admission that over the whole Owen Paterson affair, he's crashed the car into the ditch, I think. I think he's admitted that he's not necessarily fully in charge of this. But it's definitely politically important for him to take charge. And also to be seen as taking charge, not just in Westminster, but across the country.
Alice, in terms of what all of this means for Parliament, so one of the big things that's come up in the debates in the Commons has been about the people's impression of Parliament, how Parliament's reputation has been damaged over the last few weeks. What do you think the impact has been on MPs of all of this?
I think overall it's been a pretty brutal couple of weeks for Parliament's reputation with most of the public. It's, of course, important to recognise that there are lots of MPs who are concerned about standards, concerned about behaviour, who do want to see some change. It's also fair to say that there are some MPs who are much less concerned about those things. I think to the public at large, they have been seeing headlines for days and days now that are all sorts of allegations about what MPs are up to, about how Parliament is working. And I think collectively, that is not going to be a positive for people's view of what parliamentarians do all day, for their perceptions of how well they're being represented. And that is ultimately something that means that we all lose when people don't have a lot of faith in Parliament as an institution.
Yeah, absolutely. So Hannah mentioned one backbencher, Christopher Chope. Do you think it's fair to say he's one of those ones who's perhaps less concerned about Parliament's reputation? What was it that he did earlier this week, and what's the background to that?
In what might be a slightly unpopular view, I think Christopher Chope does have a little bit of a point, and he is concerned about Parliament's reputation in some ways. So Christopher Chope is a long-serving MP. He absolutely has something of a reputation. And something that he has actually been pretty consistent on in his parliamentary career is objecting to motions or to bills that might be going through without what he sees as proper debate or scrutiny. Now, often that has meant that he has objected to pieces of legislation that are on things like, for example, banning upskirting. So he is not necessarily picking the kind of most effective means to make his procedural point, but he does have a bit of a procedural point. I think the other thing it's worth saying is that Christopher Chope absolutely does have this reputation. He has always had this reputation. And I don't think the government can realistically be particularly surprised that he did this. If they know anything about his kind of previous behaviour, if they know anything about their own backbenchers, it does not come as a complete shock. Obviously, he has angered an awful lot of colleagues, both Conservatives and people from across the House. And I think it's fair to say that the kind of procedural point that he was making has probably been largely lost in terms of how this has been reported and in terms of, you know, vast swathes of the public. But, you know, this is a consistent position for him. And he does have something of a point about ensuring MPs have the chance to actually debate things.
Alice, Hannah, as sort of parliamentary watchers more generally, What does this all mean? You know, the allegations over Paterson, the stuff about second jobs, Jeffrey Cox's time in the Caribbean. It's all kind of raising questions about what we expect from MPs. Do we think, is that a debate that is going to keep running, do we think?
I think it is, and I think it's a debate that's overdue. You know, the last couple of weeks, we have understandably been very focused on thinking about what MPs should not do. But in order to figure that out, you also need to have a good understanding of what it is that you think MPs should be doing. You know, there is no sort of job description for what MPs do, and all MPs will kind of approach their jobs differently. And we've also seen lots of changes to the ways that MPs work and to the kinds of demands on their time in recent years. So, for example, MPs report having considerably more casework than they used to do. And so there are all of these kind of questions that we all need to think about, which is, how do we think MPs should balance their time between Westminster and their constituency? What kinds of responsibilities should they put first? Is it representing their constituents? Is it having a view on sort of national policy issues? Or even when it comes to actually voting on things, should they be following their own views, the views of their constituents, the views of their party? Those things do not always cohere. We saw that on Brexit. To some extent, we've seen it on COVID. You also have backbenchers who are a bit more used to holding the balance of power in the House of Commons. That's quite new. And so I think that all of that just means that there is a bit of a change that's happening in how MPs approach their job. And fundamentally, we all need to think about what that means, because that actually then has an important impact on some of those more sort of practical questions.
I think, just coming on this, I think, you know, there is always going to be variety in the way that different MPs choose to do their jobs. And there should be, because, you know, what is right for this an MP representing the City of London is not going to be right for an MP representing a very rural constituency in Scotland, for example. And so they should do their jobs differently. What I think is easier to say is that there should be, that it's possible to draw a line between when MPs are doing their jobs on behalf of the public, as the public would expect them to, whatever those different parliamentary constituency, passing legislation, whatever those roles are, and when they're doing something which they're primarily doing because they're being paid to do it and it's to their personal advantage. And I think when you look at how Scotland and Wales, for example, two legislatures who've already got rules about not being sort of political consultants as an MP, it's very clear in those places that there's a lot of things which are currently being done by Westminster MPs which would not be contemplated in Scotland or Wales. And I think there's a bit too much being made of the difficulty of drawing that line, because experience in Scotland and Wales shows that it is actually can be done. It's just not the practice so far in Westminster.
And I think the other thing as well is that, and it's something that happens in Scotland and Wales, is that members there are also encouraged to think about the perception of what they're doing. And there is a recognition that actually how members go about their jobs, even if it might be within the letter of the rules, actually you need to think about what that does to public perceptions of those institutions. And I think that that is something that all MPs can and should also be thinking about.
Absolutely. Well, the public perception of Parliament is, I think, a topic that we will be continuing to return to. So thank you very much for joining us, Alice. We will move on now from awkward questions about jobs to awkward questions about contracts. This week, details of 47 companies awarded contracts to supply personal protective equipment, PPE, through the government's high priority lane have emerged. And emerged is definitely the right word, because it took a Freedom of Information request to get the government to release the data. So what does that data tell us? And is a high priority lane the right way to go about this type of thing? Tom Sass, IFG Associate Director and our resident expert on all things procurement, joins us now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Tim.
Can you tell us, Tom, a bit more about the VIP lane and how it worked?
Yeah, so, I mean, if you cast your mind back to, this was sort of early days of the crisis, so sort of February, March, April 2020. And of course, there was this sort of really big crisis over PPE. So we just could not get enough PPE out to the front lines. We had all these terrible stories of doctors and nurses having to use bin bags and so on. And of course, the context for that was the UK's stockpile of PPE was much too small. We hadn't really prepared for this type of crisis. International supply was sort of really drying up because it was facing huge demand from countries everywhere. There were sort of export bans and things like that. And in that context, the government had a sort of deluge of offers, you know, having normally relied on a few sort of big suppliers from other countries. It then had a sort of deluge of offers from really sort of small scale cottage suppliers in the UK. Now, the problem the government had was trying to distinguish which of those suppliers was potentially selling good kit and which wasn't. And in that context, officials in the government, sort of cross-government team, decided to set up this high-priority lane. So the idea was basically that MPs, ministers, lords, you know, senior officials in the NHS could recommend a PPE supplier and that supplier would get fast-tracked through the approval process and looked at more quickly. And the government's justification for that was that these a recommendation by a kind of senior person suggested that this supplier was already more credible, and the urgency of the situation sort of justified that.
Why has it taken so long for the details of who these suppliers were to be published?
Yeah, so the NAO, the National Audit Office, published a really sort of quite critical report on this a year ago. And this was really when this whole sort of scandal about government contracts during COVID kicked off. And it's obviously sort of taken a whole 12 months for the detail of the sort of 47 particular companies to come out. The reason for that is that sort of the Department of Health and the government as a whole has sort of fought a bit of a campaign trying to reject any kind of attempts from journalists to get these details published. Ultimately, that's been overturned. The Information Commissioner's Office has said that the sort of DHSC weren't acting sort of according to the Freedom of Information Act, and they've been forced, to publish these details rather against their will.
Henry, have you had a chance to look at these? Is there anything in there that caught your eye?
I have. I mean, it's actually so the government it was leaked to Politico the list of the 47 early this week, ahead of its scheduled publication of the Freedom of Information Act. And now the government have released it today with a few more and a couple of changes made, actually. And the changes themselves are interesting. So it turns out there's 50 companies in total named on the high priority lane. And the government's publication of the document opens by stating that today's publication goes above and beyond those obligations as a measure of our commitment to openness about procurement processes during the pandemic. And I know that fellow journalists who have been sending a lot of Freedom of Information requests to the Cabinet Office and the Department of Health and Social Care question just how committed those departments have been to openness about procurement processes. But there we are. And after a long spiel, which is the department outlining why the high priority lane was necessary, you get the list. And the number of financial relationships with the Conservative Party is intriguing, to say the least. There's also my good friend Dominic Cummings makes an appearance as a person who's made a referral, though he denies it on his Twitter and claims that it's a paperwork error by the government. It's intriguing. I mean, there'll be a lot more stories to come out of it. A good amount of work has been done already, particularly sort of at the Sunday Times and Open Democracy on some of these PPE contracts over the past year.
And Tim, just to set out the bit of the context on sort of why it matters, apart from the very intriguing details about particular private relationships, which I think journalists like Henry are probably going to pore over in the coming weeks, I mean, we think about 1.7 billion worth of contracts were awarded to these companies through the high priority lane. The reason the NAO were so critical is that the companies that came through this lane were about 10 times more likely to be awarded a contract than companies that went through the normal process. And really, the government hasn't been able to offer a kind of reasonable explanation as to exactly why the companies were sort of deemed sort of so much better. So you had sort of what was interesting I found in some of the reports earlier this week, you had Lord Feldman, former sort of chairman of the Tory party, who recommended a few companies, coming out on quote saying he had no previous knowledge of these companies and he was merely passing on offers, which is sort of hard to square with the government sort of justification that, you know, these sort of recommendations showed that these were credible companies and there's sort of almost been some due diligence done already.
Absolutely. And Henry, just to expand on a point you mentioned there about, you know, transparency during the pandemic generally, do you think, has that been damaged, do you think? Do you think, is the government at risk of getting into bad habits that it will keep going after the pandemic?
Well, I think you can make the argument they're already in a bad habit. I mean, I actually just had a look at the list here, and there's one company called WorldLink Resources, and the referrer there is cited to be Lord Agnew. And I did a story earlier this year with the Sunday Times. Lord Agnew, while he did have a role to play in it, that connection was aided by former Minister Brooks Newmark. And there's a woman who sells dog food who's also involved, which is peculiar, but that's the way that PPE contracts worked during the height of the pandemic. In terms of the government's approach to transparency and openness, I think they found that they can get away with it. And I don't know why they'd choose to do anything else.
We'll see. Something we'll be keeping an eye on as well, definitely. Tom, there will be more crises in the future. What can the government learn from what's happened in this case, and what should it do differently next time?
Yeah, so I think a sort of VIP high priority lane where sort of, you know, political friends can sort of recommend people is definitely a suboptimal way to run this sort of process for a government that cares about sort of being seen to be committed to good governance processes. I think that, you know, clearly there was a tricky period early in the crisis. There was sort of huge international demand, as I said, price gouging, etc. But actually, the lessons we need to learn are much more around preparation and being in a place where we can respond to that without having to sort of cobble together these types of processes. So the first is on the sort of pandemic stockpile, and some of the assumptions in that were really quite badly mistaken. So, for example, we had thought about having enough PPE for hospitals, but we hadn't thought about having enough PPE for all social care settings, for actually the hugely wide range of places that have needed it. And that was clearly a mistake in sort of carrying through some of those risks we identified into planning. But also in terms of the procurement itself, there are actually things you can do to avoid getting into this type of situation. So other countries have taken approaches where you've sort of set up what's called an emergency procurement framework. You have an agreement in place with some companies that should a crisis hit, they will sort of scale up their production. I think the last thing that's probably going to come out of this is actually whether the UK needs to invest a bit more in having a bit of a domestic supply base for some of these sort of goods and things that it thinks are critical in a crisis. We've seen that discussion over vaccines, but also over sort of, you know, medicines, things like PPE might be a good argument for having some domestic production too.
Brilliant. Well, lots more to look at there, I'm sure, over the next coming months and years. Thank you, Tom, for joining us. Finally, today, let's swap now Westminster for Holyrood, because this week the IFG hosted, virtually, Scotland's Deputy First Minister John Swinney for a talk which pulled few punches.
Much to my regret, the United Kingdom government is engaged in a project of undermining good governance in these islands. And under the UK's constitution, there appears little anyone can do to stop them. That project exposes the fact that the UK is not what many people in Scotland believed or hoped it to be, a partnership of equals. Instead of partnership, we have what is sometimes euphemistically called muscular unionism, but which in fact means Westminster control of Scotland, even, perhaps especially, in devolved areas. The Brexit campaign's favourite slogan, "Take Back Control," has now been extended well beyond the context of the European Union question. It is also about the UK government taking back control from Scotland, from Wales, and from other institutions that prove an irritation to those now in charge of the United Kingdom government.
Swinney was in conversation with Akash Pound, IFG Senior Fellow, who joins us now. Hi, Akash.
Hi, Tim.
Can you tell us, what was Swinney talking about?
Well, as we just heard from that clip of the speech, it was a pretty hard-hitting intervention by John Swinney. And his central argument was essentially that the UK government is using the power of parliamentary sovereignty, unconstrained now by EU law as well, to undermine devolution, to take back control from other alternative centres of power, such as the courts. And yes, in terms of the devolution side of that, as part of a strategy, as John Swinney put it, of muscular unionism, to coin that phrase. And so he was very critical, for instance, of some of the legislation the UK government has passed, which has amended the terms of devolution, most notably the UK Internal Market Act, without the consent of the devolved institutions. He was also critical of the new spending powers that UK ministers have, well, essentially given themselves to determine the spending of public money in the devolved nations, even on devolved matters such as local economic development, education, and transport. Obviously, in his view, the solution to that ultimately is independence for Scotland. That's no surprise, as an SNP minister, the Deputy First Minister, that he would lead to end up at that conclusion. But I think it is also worth noting that a lot of what he was saying is not just a nationalist argument. I mean, certainly the Welsh government, which is a Labour government, is highly critical of the UK government for similar reasons. So too a party such as Scottish Labour and Scottish Liberal Democrats to some extent.
the UK Internal Market Act, let's talk about that in a bit more detail. What does that do? What's it for? And why does the UK government want it?
Well, yeah, the Institute for Government has published quite a bit on that, which people might want to refer to. But, I mean, in essence, this is legislation that the UK government brought forward in its terms to protect the continued functioning of the internal market of the UK after Brexit. And this was seen as necessary because, obviously, while the UK was an EU member, EU law provided a common set of rules about, for instance, what goods and services can be provided all across the EU single market. After Brexit, where the underlying legislative competence is devolved, as it is, for instance, over food standards and lots of aspects of environmental regulation, the conclusion the UK government came to was that there was a risk that there'd be divergence of law and regulation, and that that would effectively create trade barriers between, say, England and Scotland. So this legislation was forced through to prevent that. And what it does is it requires that if a product is eligible for sale in any part of the UK, then all the other parts of the UK must also allow it for sale. These are the so-called market access principles. And so from a Scottish perspective, that means that if they were to try to ban the use of the sale of single-use plastics, which is an example that John Swinney gave, they could ban it in Scotland, but if it were still allowed in England, then those products could, the Scottish government couldn't prevent their sale in Scotland. So it's seen as an undermining of devolved autonomy.
And you mentioned about, you know, there are kind of rocky relationships between the devolved governments in Cardiff, in Edinburgh and London. How long has that been going? Is that because of Brexit? Is it because of the pandemic? And what are the different attitudes towards the UK government from the devolved government?
Relationships are obviously quite poor, I think, between the UK government and, in some respect, all three of the devolved governments. And a lot of it does come back to Brexit. In the case of Scotland and Northern Ireland, of course, the underlying issue is that people in those parts of the country didn't even vote for Brexit. But it's not just that. I mean, I think the whole way the Brexit process unfolded without, at many key points, much involvement of the devolved administrations really strained those relationships. And then some of the legislation that has been passed to make Brexit work in the view of the UK government, not least that UK Internal Market Act, has made things even worse. I mean, one obvious difference is that in the end, the Welsh government does want the union to hold together, but it wants that to be on a fundamentally different basis. So, I mean, the Welsh government it doesn't always use this word, but it is effectively pushing for a federal constitution of the UK in which devolved powers would be constitutionally entrenched. So Parliament would no longer be sovereign. The Scottish government, in the end, wants to leave the UK, as we know. But in the meantime, it's also got a similar desire to protect devolution from what it sees as Westminster's new willingness to rewrite the rules of the game.
Yeah. And so do you think, is there any hope for relations getting better?
It's quite hard to see it in the short run, because the UK government believes that the best way to hold the union together is to be more assertive, is to play a more visible role all across the UK. No more devolve and forget, as they put it. So that's why they've created things like the Levelling Up Fund, so that it's UK ministers spending money and being seen to spend money in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, rather than, as previously was the pattern, just spending money in England and then handing over money via the Barnett formula for devolved ministers to decide on allocation within their own nations. So that's the UK government strategy. The devolved governments are never really going to like it or accept it. And so I think we are just in a period of quite tense and strained relations.
It's also somewhat political. It's not just a matter of, you know, the UK government is fundamentally invested in the concept of the union. It's about causing conflict between Conservatives and the SNP, both in Westminster, and for to hope that, you know, the Conservatives want to take more seats in Scotland, but also between the Conservatives and Labour. The Conservatives, a lot of the time in the House of Commons, you'll see them point to the Labour government as an example in Wales, and you'll see only today the Suella Braverman talked about how she thought an SNP MP should focus more on the declining standards in schools in Scotland. The union is a way for the UK government and the Conservative Party to bash the other parties with the hope of winning more seats in the next election. And there's also legislation they're doing related to that. So the elections bill, which is going through Parliament at the moment, has had its legislative consent refused by both the Welsh Assembly and the Scottish Parliament, which is, you know, highly irregular. Because for all parties, it's a way to stand up and identify themselves by through opposition. Mm-hmm. So the Conservatives make this argument about voter ID and election fraud, whereas the Scots are saying very strongly that, you know, to bring this bill into Scotland would create an inconsistency between how Scottish elections are run and how the general election is run, which, to be fair, is actually useful because it shows a difference in how the country is run and different approaches to the direction the country should take.
Hannah, on the topic we started with, you mentioned how the parliaments in Scotland and Wales have different approaches to MPs' jobs and standards. Is there more that the UK government and parliament can learn from the devolved legislatures?
I think it's important to realise that we're not now starting from the same place as the devolved legislatures were. Their codes of conduct were put in pretty early, and these are younger legislatures, so it's easier because the expectations of members were set from the start. And part of the thing that makes it so difficult to sort out the situation in Westminster now is you have lots and lots of MPs who are already in jobs in different sort of contractual relationships who are now sort of thinking, well, is this going to be permitted or not? So it's a question of how much and who you ask to unwind things that they're already doing. But I think it is really instructive, as I said before, to realise that actually these rules do work relatively straightforward way in Scotland and Wales. And so it shouldn't be impossible for Westminster to do something quite similar. There just might be a transition period, which it feels a bit painful for some MPs.
Absolutely. And on a different matter on standards, while Westminster Parliament is a bit more entrenched, it's entirely within the whim of the Prime Minister to change the ministerial code if he wanted to change it to bring it more in line with how ministerial code works in Scotland and Wales.
We've also looked at, we haven't talked much about Northern Ireland yet, but in Northern Ireland, the ministerial code is set out in law. There are obviously different sort of political history in Northern Ireland, but there is much more kind of regulation around ministerial and government standards in Stormont legislation than there is in Westminster. Right, we can't talk about devolution without talking about Scottish independence. Akash, you mentioned, obviously, that's the SNP's kind of overarching goal, but we haven't heard much about another referendum recently, have we? Do you think that might return?
I think it's definitely about to return to the agenda. I mean, the Scottish government made quite a big thing at the start of the pandemic in early 2020 or spring 2020 of putting on hold their preparatory work for independence and for a referendum. And Nicola Sturgeon said, you know, now's not the time to focus on that when we've got this emergency to deal with. But this autumn, the Scottish government has said that they're restarting work on the detailed prospectus that will guide the decision of the Scottish people. That was, as Nicola Sturgeon put it to the Scottish Parliament in September, I think it was. So, yes, I think John Swinney's speech yesterday, to some extent, was a sign that they're moving into a new phase of their campaign for referendum number two on independence to take place. SNP policy, Scottish Government policy, is to hold that referendum by the end of 2023. And that means if it is to happen on that timescale, which I think is frankly unlikely, but they will need to move fast because it's not something that you can obviously rush into. So we'll see exactly how it unfolds, of course. But what we are expecting is probably another formal request by the Scottish Parliament to the UK government to pass a Section 30 order, as it's called, that would allow a referendum to take place legally, which is what happened for the 2014 referendum. That's probably going to be denied. The SNP has said, it was in its manifesto this year, that it will probably just try and legislate for a referendum regardless. It's published a draft bill for a second referendum. They can try and push that through. They've got the numbers in Holyrood, but that is likely to end up in court. And expectation of most people is that any legislation on an independence referendum is very likely to be struck down on the grounds that it falls outside the powers of the Scottish Parliament.
Well, something to keep an eye on then, I'm sure, as you say, it'll be, you know, it'll be a big topic in the coming months. Thank you very much. So that is it for this edition of Inside Briefing after a packed and unpredictable week in British politics. My huge thanks to Hannah White, Alice Lilly, Akash Pound, Tom Sass, and especially to Henry Dyer. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you all for listening at home. If you like this podcast, then do check out our sister podcast, IFG Live, where you can hear Akash's interview with John Swinney in full, and another with Andy Street, Mayor of the West Midlands. And of course, please leave us a review. No amendments from us. We'll be delighted with whatever you write. Remember, you can find all of our work at instituteforgovernment.org.uk, and we'll be back next week. I imagine the Prime Minister hopes we've all moved on from talking about jobs and standards, but this story probably still has some way to go. See you then.